Hi, everybody. Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have Rabbi Ephraim Buchholz. Rabbi Buchholz is the dean, the founder of the concept of beginner's minyanim. And we have an article that is being written for the Jewish Action, and all of you, I'm sure, are seeing, called Wanted, People Who Talk During Davening by Steve Lippman. And Rabbi Buchholz, how are you, my friend? How's everything?
Very good. It's great to hear your voice again.
Absolutely wonderful.
And I'm very fond of your program. It's a great asset to the Jewish community.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. So I think the title itself is interesting, People Who Talk During Davening. Well, that's just about most Jews, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, that's great. I think it's great. My father used to say, if you have a child who doesn't speak, you know, has trouble developing speech, bring him to shul. He'll learn to speak.
Oh, you know, I like that. That's good.
Yeah.
Someone once asked the question, said, why are Orthodox Jewish people such great business people? Because they have three times a day, all they think about is business.
All right.
Anyway, so the article is very interesting, and it talks about the whole concept now of the beginner's minyan. And you, of course, way back when in 1975 in Lincoln Square Synagogue, were the first person to really start a beginner's minyan. So what happened?
Well, I have to take issue with that because I wasn't really the first person to start beginner services. There were beginner services, you know, on an ad hoc basis, done by, let's say, at seminars, Torah leadership seminars and things like that, you know, where we used to go in and we used to have a bridge services or even Hebrew school services. Lincoln Square Synagogue, when it first started, I know that Rabbi Riskin used to run a Friday night service with Rabbi Cohn, and it was sort of like a beginner service. But ours probably was the first one to begin on a regular basis, certainly on a weekly basis. Some places ran it on a monthly basis, some ran it bi-monthly. But Lincoln Square Synagogue in December of 1975 began the beginner services there. And it really was an incredible undertaking. Rabbi Riskin had offered me an opportunity to conduct an overflow minyan to the main shul. You know, the new building opened up in 1970 and immediately was packed and overwhelmed. And he was on my case to run an overflow service, and I really wasn't interested in doing that. And then I had a student who was in my class. His name was Steve Reich. And he said to me, you know, my wife, my girlfriend, and I, we don't really know how to pray. If you would run a special service for people with little no background, we'd come. And it turns out that Steve Reich became this incredibly famous composer. He's won the equivalent of two Nobel Prizes in music. We ran this beginner service in December of 1975 together with another person by the name of Steve Reich, not related, and myself. And there was this guy who used to, like, wander in on roller skates with a tennis racket, and he used to ask every other week, you know, how do you know that there was a God? And I said, this is never going to work because the best show in town is upstairs. Rabbi Riskin, who was then known as Stevie Wonder, and Sherwood Goffin were conducting services. People were clamoring to get in. Who was going to come down to a ballroom, an empty ballroom with three people there, known as a beginner service? The name itself is pejorative and is going to want to learn. Well, slowly people drifted in. And before you knew it, we had somewhat of a quorum. And then, I think it was the early 1980s, the New York Times did a second section cover story. That was the place to get your article in. And they did a front page, second section story on the beginner service. And the rest was history. It was a standing room only. And we've had a spectacular run of 37, 38 years, even to this day.
So the New York Times... Little did they know that they were going to be the impetus for this whole great movement, the Baal Tshuva movement, you see?
Well, it was moving along as, it was developing very nicely, but the New York Times really put it on the map.
Okay, so, you know, I think it's interesting because many people hear beginner services, and over Rosh Hashanah you see a lot of advertisements for that. You don't see them so much during the year, but you see it, you know, on Rosh Hashanah. And I know that even Rabbi Weil, who did this in Los Angeles and also now was doing it this several last years in Ketet Torah in Teaneck, was telling me that he actually also decided to do this. And lo and behold, many of the people from the regular shul said they'd like to come to that, because they thought it would be more interesting, more spiritual, and more enjoyable. So maybe we have to start thinking about how we change our regular davening also.
I agree with that heartily. And that is because, first of all, davening is very, very long. Whenever I go and I speak about davening, people complain that it's too long. And I wonder about it myself, you know, how did it become so long? I think because, you know, a python wrote a piet and put it in, you know, it became standard, and we just kept adding and adding and adding. And I think that if you're able to focus on a limited number of tefillot in an intense way, it becomes that much more meaningful. And our beginner service is sort of like a free-flowing beginner service because you can stop it virtually at any time and ask a question about the tefillah that we're saying, you know, except in certain inappropriate times. So it becomes very, very animated. It becomes very, very exciting, especially for the people. There is a guy in my beginner service that I've been trying to kick out. Usually the rule is that you're allowed to stay in the beginner service for 6 months to a year and a half, or until you've heard my jokes five times, or you know exactly what I'm going to say, you know, because you've heard it so many times. You know how I'm going to, you know, take three steps backwards and three steps forward. This guy has been in the beginner service. He's 85 years old. He's been in the beginner service for 15 years. And he plots every week. He spends the whole week. He's a very, very famous retired physician. Plots a whole week to catch me, you know, gotcha. And he does research during the week, asks me these convoluted questions, and I just use my standard excuse. I'm just a beginner's rabbi. You have to ask a real rabbi for that, you know. So, but it's very, very exciting for him. For me, I learned so much, and the people who contribute also have, like, incredible, incredible insights. Some woman, actually, this Yom Kippur from China, who became a Gioris about a year and a half ago. She once identified herself as an MOTIT. I'm a member of the tribe in training. And then when she converted, 2 days later, she says, I'm FST. I'm from since Tuesday. Anyway, she gave the Dvar Torah, and she drew an analogy, which I thought was fantastic. I still have to understand the implications of the Seir Lazazel, that we send a goat out into the wilderness, and that we read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah that Hagar and Ishmael were sent out to the wilderness. It never dawned on me, you know. And here, this is Mikomalam Dayiskalti. We really learn from these people. They have incredible insights into Torah that you would never, ever imagine.
That's beautiful,
It makes it so exciting.
Yes. So let me ask you, let's take one simple question like this person asked you, that, you know, would be typical of what the kind of what people would ask at the minyan.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
In other words, like, you know, you were talking about this doctor who's always preparing and asking. So give me an example of a question that he might ask, which someone in the audience who probably davens all the time, probably says the words a million times and never thinks about it.
You know, he would ask me, for instance, let's say, is it true that John the Baptist wrote Aleinu or something like that, or wrote Nishmas, you know? You know, some of these very esoteric questions that I would have to go back and research. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that there are some sources that attribute some of our prayers to early Christian fathers, you know, and that raises all sorts of questions about that. The question of why we don't kneel anymore, but, you know, that's a germane question on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Why we dress in white? Are we allowed to, what can we use for kiddush, you know, if we can't drink wine or we can't drink grape juice? These are all types of questions that the beginners ask. And, of course, they might ask something about their home, about making their homes kosher. The other things that are, I would say, germane to our audience here is, how do you develop the kavana? How do you really develop kavana? How do you pray intently? And I think that this is something that needs to be addressed. First of all, you know, they're always complaining that they go to shul, they go to a regular shul, which was what we'd hope to do, to mainstream them into a regular shul. And first of all, the people are talking all the time. Secondly, they daven so fast that it's impossible to follow the words. So I've come up with a pat answer and saying, you know, that these guys love God so much that they can't wait to get the words out of their mouth. You know, that's why they're davening so...
They're anxious, they're anxious.
Right, they're just so in love with God. Of course, they know that that's not really true in most instances. But for them, and I tell them the truth, is that my kavana is the greatest when I'm with the beginners. Because when I daven, I may know the meaning of each and every word, but my mind may be drifting. You know, are the Yankees going to make the playoffs? Or what other, you know, world-shattering issues there may be. And I see them with their intensity, and it serves as an inspiration. And that's what really davening with Tzibur is about. That if you're in a Tzibur that davens with intensity, that davens with kavana, even if they don't understand every word, but they take it so seriously, it impacts on you. It impacts on me. And I know that this is true because when I go to a regular minyan, it's not the same intensity that I feel when I'm davening with these beginners. And I think it's a very, very important thing to try to be, if you can't find a shul that has these intensive people, then try to sit or stand next to people who daven with intensity. And I think that that makes a big, will make a big impact on your davening.
No, no, I agree with you about that. But how would you, let's say that if you were going to be running the regular minyan, quote-unquote, whatever that means, how would you modify or change the davening in a way to bring back this kavana, spirituality, sense of purpose? I mean, you know, I could look at, I mean, sometimes I ask somebody a question, and this was not during a Shabbos even, it was during the week. I asked people in one of the shuls I go to, 5 minutes before davening, I said, you know, what do you hope to accomplish? And most of them just look at me, what do you mean by what do I accomplish? I'm here, you know? Okay. And when they finish, you ask them 5 minutes later, so do you feel any different now than you did before? And for the most part, I'm not saying it's true with everyone because it's not, but for the most part, most people don't tell me they don't feel that much different 6:35 than they did at 5:55. So,
well, first of all, I want to be melamed zchus on those people, you know, who you know, are trying to get it over with as quick as possible and who may even talk. We have 93-94% of American Jews never go to shul, you know, on a regular basis. They don't go, okay? If a guy comes to shul and talks about, you know, the tennis match, or talks about Wall Street, talks about the stock market, I find it very difficult to condemn a person like that. Baruch Hashem, he's in shul. It's true that he's not going to win Jew of the Year award, okay? But we have to realize that this is a madrega, and it's not just a madrega, it's a madrega leona. It's really a very high level. He's in shul. A Jew is in shul today in America, you know, when four-fifths of the Jewish people are not, okay? So first I want to be melamed zchus on that person. Then it's our responsibility to engage them, okay? The failure of the synagogues is not the failures of the balabatim, it's the failures of the leadership. It's our failure. I personally feel a responsibility, if I fail, to get my message across to the tzibur that I'm trying to lead. And I think that the rabbis have to take the responsibility. And so my balabatim are talking all the time. It's not fair. Well, what kind of model does the rabbi provide? And that's also a very, very important thing. Do they really take the rabbi as a very serious davener? Now, I'll tell you the truth. You know, when I go into a regular shul, I was a big talker. I was a big talker until pretty recently. I took upon myself a neder on behalf of a friend of mine who was diagnosed with a very serious cancer that I would not talk. And that has made a profound difference. I carry around a little note that I got from Yitzhak Rosenbaum, our associate director for many years, which says, you know, I've taken upon myself a neder not to talk during davening. Please don't talk to me. If someone comes over to me, I show them the note, you know, because this person's name. And that has made a tremendous, tremendous impact on me when I'm in shul.
And you use this the whole time.
Yeah, and everybody knows someone who needs a refuah, someone who desperately needs a refuah. And if you mark down that person's name and you just put it on a kittel and you say, you know, that I've taken upon myself not to talk during davening, that is already, again, an elevated madrega that will impact on your davening and on other people's davening. And people don't come over to me anymore to talk. They know not to come over to me to talk, yeah.
So they just wait till when davening's over, that's when you start again.
That's right. Yeah, we start again. We can, you know, do all the Lashon Hara, Chas V'Shalom. One of the things that we do at the beginning of service is emphasize Lashon Hara. That's very, very good. You know, because, you know, we say Elokai Nitzar L'Shani Mara at the end. So before we say Elokai Nitzar L'Shani Mara in English, you know, Lord, guard my tongue from speaking evil, I read a book from Zelig Plissken, Guard Your Tongue. And I read a selection every single week. and then I ask them to take a few moments out to think of the opportunities they've had in the past week to refrain from speaking evil and from hurting others with their tongues. This becomes a very, very keen point of discussion. I don't know, I maybe have learned this from Abner Weiss, I think, when I was in South Africa with him. But I think I saw him introduce that, and I thought it was a great idea, that before Elokeinu Tzar, we read, something about Lashon Hara, and it also impacts on... You see, Lashon Hara, for a beginner, is a great thing, because it doesn't mean that you have to throw out your dishes, you don't have to stop working on Shabbos, you can turn the lights on, But you can guard your tongue. And that is a very, very, very big mitzvah. And they understand that.
Great. That's a good idea. Now, there's a quote in here, by the way, from you. Once again, I'm assuming you said it, but it said...
I will disassociate myself for a minute if I don't like it.
It said that I ran the greatest beginner's minyan in the world. I didn't say that. It says, it was once estimated that the chances of those who attended the beginner service for 2 consecutive months, 8 consecutive Shabbatot, of becoming Shomer Shabbos and Kashrus were about 3 out of 5.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I think it is the most effective tool to bring a person to Shmiras HaMitzvahs, right? That if a person attended the Lincoln Square, I would imagine it would apply to many beginner services, but if a person attended 8 weeks consecutively, 3 out of 5 would kasher their homes. I mean, we... during its heyday, we koshered maybe 50 homes a year. You know, and remember, the beginner service was limited to 50 people. When we ran the beginner service, before we end up started beginner services all over the country, so we were the only show in town. Now every shul on the west side has a beginner service, so that we're not the only place they go to. So we had standing room only. If you came after 10 o'clock, you couldn't get in. And the place was packed, but I limited it to 50 because it was important for me to have a personal relationship with every person there. If you have more than 50, let's say, like Rosh Hashanah, we'll have 200, 250 people, but it doesn't have the same impact because you don't have that personal relationship with it. If I limited it to 50, I could have them all over, not at one time, but I could have each one of them over in our house for a Shabbos meal. I could get to know them personally. I would know their names, their phone numbers, and I would be... able to establish a personal relationship with them. Once you have that personal relationship with them and they come on a regular basis, then it's not so difficult for them to make that transformation if they're serious about it. If they're not serious about it, they're going to miss right. weeks. They're not going to come.
Uh-huh. But you're saying coming for 8 consecutive weeks.
8 consecutive weeks, right. That's already a chayvus. You've made a commitment, and that's a serious commitment.
So
yeah.
That's amazing. And now, do you do a lot of singing in the minyan also? Is it a Kalbach kind of thing?
We do. We generally use the standard melodies that are used in the shul. Again, the whole point is to graduate them and to mainstream them into the main shul. We once had an intermediate service, which really was incredible, people actually learned how to be shlichei tzibur and to lein. But that's a very, very difficult... thing to lead. I don't know if I would be successful at it, there was a very successful intermediate service at Lincoln Square Synagogue. What we do now is that a person who graduates, we ask them where they're going to daven, and if they're going to daven at Lincoln Square, we can set them up with a buddy, usually from the beginner service, previous beginners, who can sit next to them and show them ropes. If they're going to go to another shul, try to make a connection and integrate them there. We have people from the beginner service who become rabbis, rebbetzins. I mean, we must have probably 50 rebbetzins. Maybe 10,000 people have gone through the beginner service in the last 37 years. We have over 250 families living in Eretz Yisrael. One guy is a Rosh Yeshiva, one guy is a Rosh Kollel, one guy is like unbelievable, what these people. Also, we get because we're in Midtown, we get all these very, very interesting people. Like we get the music director of Broadway. We get writers for the New York Times, how many magazines, publishers. It's always been very fascinating. I think we've gotten 2 dancers from, the Rockettes. One actually is a Balas Tshuva today, and it's
oh, wow.
like an amazing thing. We got the president, Morgan Stanley.
How do people hear about it? Just word of mouth?
Well, now it's word of mouth. You know, in ancient times, we used to advertise. One of the greatest things that happened to us is that a woman whose children had come to the beginner service, and she was just, you know, the son had gone to Harvard and the daughter, you know, and she couldn't understand how her children were into this primitive orthodoxy, and she started coming. Turned out that she was editor, I forget which magazine she was editor of, but she had been an editor of the Sunday Times magazine. And she decided to write a story on the new Orthodox, you know, and this was a cover. This was a major story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in 1984 about how America. It was called "How American Jews Rediscovered Orthodoxy," and it featured a picture of a Nobel Prize winner who was building a sukkah, and it had Zalman Bernstein from Wall Street with his bowler cap and a talus on his veranda, and Alan Light, who was the producer, Kate Nally, and it showed for the first time that American Jews can be successful and not give up their Judaism. Until then, everybody knew that if you were successful, you were no longer religious. And here were religious Jews, Arnio Penzias, Bell Laboratories, Nobel Prize winner, you know, he was building his sukkah, and Alan Light walking his kids to shul. It was such an amazing story. And from that story alone, I mean, it was worth tens of millions of dollars of publicity. The mind frame of orthodoxy was transformed. Then we had, I think, two cover stories on New York Magazine. About there was one that was the new Orthodox, and then there was another one about the disappearing American Jew. And those were less positive, you know, in terms of the future of American Judaism, but also had a big, big impact. So we were very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. I don't think it has that much to do with talent.
Rabbi Bruchwald, it's the right place at the right time with the right person. That's what it is. Listen, I think the listening audience can get a flavor for why you've been so successful, and we can go on and on and on and on. But, you know, listen, I wanted to say thank you on behalf of the Jewish community. What you've done has been totally incredible.
It's my pleasure.
NJOP has been wildly successful.
I want to bless the union, the Orthodox Union, for everything they're doing, for all the food that I eat, for all the weight that I gain, and keep those Oreo cookies kosher, you know, whatever it is.
We'll try to do everything, but
the work that you're doing with NCSY and all the special activities that you have. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Be well.
You play a primary role as chairman and as president. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Be well. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.